It's Friday, October 11, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The political drama continues to unfold in Washington. Yesterday, President Obama met with some congressional leaders in an attempt to avoid a crisis over the nation's debt ceiling. But as was reported by The Wall Street Journal, what is being proposed is a plan to extend the crisis, at least the deadline of the crisis, for 6 weeks and to permanently ban the Treasury Department from using what are called extraordinary measures to avoid a default. In essence, this means that this proposal would make the problem less likely and more likely simultaneously to erupt. And that's the problem. This is just another effort by Congress and the White House together to kick the can down the street just 6 weeks down the road. Once again, what we're looking at is politics as theater, and it's becoming tiresome for the United States and frustrating to the rest of the world watching. Both political parties are playing this. The White House and Congress are playing this to what they believe will be their own political advantage. The American people appear to be frustrated and confused, trying to figure out exactly what their political leaders are trying to say by shutting down the government or by claiming that the government is shut down. One recent estimate is that only 17% of the government is actually shut down anyway, which tells us something very interesting. This government has become so enormous, such a monster in its own terms, that even when it's shut down, 83% of it is still alive. Of course, much of that needs to be very much active, our armed services and all the rest, emergency services. But this political drama is growing tiresome, and the American people understand that it's just one incident after another, pseudo-events put together with complicity from both parties in the Congress and from Congress in the White House together, with no apparent end in sight. The article in the Wall Street Journal about this proposal from House Republicans to extend the debt ceiling for 6 weeks, the article by Damian Paletta, Patrick O'Connor, and Christina Peterson, includes this very significant paragraph. Even though the steps are called emergency measures, they have become employed so routinely during recent fiscal standoffs that Congress often waits for the emergency steps to be exhausted before beginning negotiations on raising the borrowing limit. End quote. Some of you may well remember that fable about the boy that cried wolf. In this case, Congress is saying we're going to cry wolf a little earlier than we did last time, so you'll take us more seriously. There's something very telling here, not only from a political analysis, but from even the use of language, a moral analysis. What does it mean that the word emergency no longer actually means an emergency? Before long, no one pays attention to it as an actually urgent matter any longer. Or in this case, a political crisis, an almost regularly scheduled political crisis, in which both parties in Congress and Congress and the White House together might decide to postpone for a very convenient 6 weeks. Meanwhile, continuing our consideration of this political crisis, a very interesting article appeared this week in New York Magazine. The columnist was Jonathan Chait, generally a man of the left. He's arguing in this column entitled The Shutdown Prophet that what we are now witnessing in Washington might well be the meltdown of our constitutional order. It's not an irrelevant or a marginal argument. It's a very interesting argument, even if we have to hope Jonathan Chait is wrong. Chait cites the late Spanish political scientist Juan Lentz, who died just last week. What makes Juan Lentz so interesting in this discussion is that Lentz argued years ago that the constitutional system, where you have the legislature on one hand, checked and balanced by the executive, by the president on the other, is inherently unstable. As a matter of fact, he says such constitutional systems almost never work. He did point to the United States as an exception to that rule. But that exception, he said, was due to the fact that both parties had worked out a compromise, a working agreement, whereby, regardless of who was in the White House, regardless of who was in control of which chamber or both chambers in the House and the Senate, the two parties would work together towards at least some very central political goals. They wouldn't shut down the government. The shutdown of the government is actually the kind of thing that points to political pathologies in other systems, the kind of systems that have pointed to failed states and failed governments. Is the United States continuing as an exception to Lentz's principle? Well, you have to wonder, given the current propensity towards these repeated government shutdowns and the political impasse. But the bigger point of Lentz's analysis is this. When you have Congress and the White House, it turns out that in the American constitutional order, either one can basically shut down the other. If Congress is determined to shut down the White House, it can come very close to doing so. If the White House wants to shut down Congress, it can do its very best by executive authority to try to go around the Congress. At the end of the day, both central political institutions, Congress and the White House, can try to trump the other in terms of long-term political influence and political power. If that's the game that's being played, it becomes a very dangerous game. Our constitutional framers, our national founders, worked to put together an order that would distribute influence and power by this separation of powers. But that was not to keep government from working. It was instead to make certain that the totalitarian temptation would not be something to which either or any of the units of government could succumb. In other words, to maintain the operation of government while preventing some totalitarian or dictatorial system from emerging. Perhaps this column by Jonathan Chait, citing the Spanish political philosopher Juan Lentz, should remind us of something that we ought to keep in mind as Americans and as Christians. There is nothing written into nature that says that the American system of government, our own constitutional order, must always continue. It is a political achievement, and it is an achievement that must be secured in every generation. It is a system put at risk with the kind of political drama now going on in Washington and beyond. We've often discussed the fact that the state of California is a political and cultural bellwether for the United States. It's something of a social laboratory for this society. In other words, what happens in California first often later spreads to the other 49 states, especially when it comes to entertainment and also major cultural movements. Keep that in mind when you recognize that this week Governor Jerry Brown of California has signed into law a provision that will expand availability to abortion, expanding it in such a way that doctors are no longer required to perform abortions. Now, nurse practitioners and certain other non-physicians can perform the procedure during the first trimester of pregnancy. The logic of Governor Brown was very simple and straightforward. Women ought to have even more access to abortion. The argument was that if women had greater access to abortion in the early trimester, they would have a later need for late trimester or late pregnancy abortions. But what we're looking at, of course, here is a radical step towards making abortion not only more routine, but now downsizing it in terms of its medical significance so that a doctor no longer has to perform what is, by any definition, a surgical procedure. Without going into graphic detail, the kind of abortion that is discussed here is a vacuum abortion, and that is a very brutal physical surgical procedure. By the way, one thing to note in this particular story is that the reason Governor Brown signed this law and the reason why they want to expand the ability of non-physicians to perform abortions is because abortion still carries a stigma in the medical community. Fewer doctors today are performing abortions than was true 20 years ago in America. And that's not because of legislation. That's because doctors don't want to say that their medical practice comes down to abortion. And for good reason. If nothing else, even as doctors may say they support abortion, they don't want to be associated with it personally in terms of their medical practice. That reality is telling in and of itself. Meanwhile, also on the issue of abortion, the state of Ohio is moving in the opposite direction of California toward the direction of increased restrictions on abortion. Fascinating story appeared just in recent days in the New York Times. The article by Eric Eckholm declares, with new abortion restrictions, Ohio walks a narrow legal line. Let's listen to how Eckholm introduces his story. Quote, Angela H., married with two children, became pregnant accidentally, and after medical complications during her last pregnancy and severe postpartum depression, said neither she nor her family was ready for another child. Under a law that took effect in Ohio this month, the Cleveland abortion clinic she visited had to offer her a chance not only to view an ultrasound of the fetus, but also to watch its beating heart, which she said she resented. She went on to say, quote, it's a hard decision for anyone to make. To make it more difficult by passing these laws and making women feel guilty is terrible, end quote. Now let's look very carefully at exactly what the New York Times said here. What is it that the law in Ohio required the Cleveland abortion clinic to do? Let me read these words. To offer her a chance not only to view an ultrasound of the fetus, but also to watch its beating heart. The law in Ohio required the abortion clinic to offer this mother a chance to see an ultrasound image of her child and to watch its beating heart, and she resented the chance. Notice her language again. She said, to make it more difficult by passing these laws and making women feel guilty is terrible, end quote. This raises a host of issues, not only about abortion, but about guilt. One of the major issues in our contemporary culture is that the secular culture has categorized all guilt as that which we should seek to avoid. Guilt is simply a negative mental state. It is our business, not only as individuals, but as a society, to try to keep people from feeling guilty. But in a biblical frame of reference, guilt is a moral gift, a gift that is given to human beings because God made us in His own image, such that we are moral creatures, and guilt is necessary in order to tell us of our wrongdoing and to make very clear we need salvation from our sin, a salvation that we cannot accomplish on our own, a salvation that only another can accomplish for us and that would be none other than Jesus Christ. What we're looking at here is the reality that guilt is supposed to make us cringe in this article, such that we would then recoil in horror at a law that would make a woman seeking an abortion feel guilty, if for nothing else, only being offered the chance to see an ultrasound and an image of the beating heart of her child. Maybe this is a telling sign of the direction of our culture, theologically as well as culturally and morally. What we're being told here, implicitly in this article from the New York Times, is that it is we who should feel guilty for putting a woman in the position of being made to feel guilty as she is contemplating the abortion of her baby. The statement that this woman featured in the article made is so telling, we need to hear it again. Quote, "To make it more difficult by passing these laws and making women feel guilty is terrible," end quote. What we're talking about here is the deliberate death of a child. And we're supposed to feel guilty because a woman is offered the chance to see a beating heart in an ultrasound that makes her feel guilty. Again, speaking of abortion, a very important article appeared in Tuesday's edition of the New York Times. The headline is Breakthroughs in Prenatal Screening. The article is by Jane E. Brody. As she writes, more than 30 years ago, a 37-year-old friend of mine with an unplanned fourth pregnancy was told by her obstetrician that an amniocentesis was too dangerous and could cause a miscarriage. She ultimately bore a child severely affected by Down syndrome, which could have been detected with the test. Today, my friend's story, she writes, would have a very different trajectory. She would have a series of screening tests, and if the results suggested a high risk of Down syndrome, then an amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling to make the diagnosis. She'd be given the option to abort the pregnancy, end quote. What's really both obvious and ominous in this article is that Jane Brody writes as if we should all celebrate the fact that prenatal testing is allowing women the option of aborting their pregnancy if the child does not measure up to their genetic expectations. She celebrates, and I quote, "Prenatal diagnosis, today a routine part of obstetric care, has made great strides since the mid-1970s and is now on the cusp of further revolutionary developments," end quote. She's right about that, at least the society being on the cusp of future and further revolutionary developments. Promises are out there from the medical community that prenatal testing can now be based upon non-invasive tests that can eventually give a rather comprehensive genetic profile of the unborn child, such that the parents can make the decision, do we want to have the child or not? Does this child meet our expectations, or will we abort the pregnancy and then hope for another? It is for this reason that one book written several years ago suggested that virtually every pregnancy in America today should be considered a tentative pregnancy. We'll simply see if we continue the pregnancy once we have an adequate amount of information to know whether this is the child we want or not. Throughout most of this article, there's no apparent moral concern about what it would mean to abort a child simply because it is carrying the marker for Down syndrome. And then, about three-quarters of the way through the article, a moral concern appears. But wait until you see what it is. Quote, "In a recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine, Stephanie Moraine, a doctoral candidate at Harvard who studies medical ethics, and her co-authors said the fetal DNA tests have some disadvantages." Well, let's insert here and say, what must those disadvantages be? She writes, quote, "They miss some chromosomal abnormalities detected by standard screening techniques, and they're not widely covered by insurance. Prices for the tests range from about $800 to more than $2,000, though some companies offer introductory pricing specials at about $200, end quote. So what are the ethical concerns being raised by these people at Harvard? The fact that the tests don't catch enough genetic abnormalities that some continue to slip through. In other words, by implication, there are babies who are born who wouldn't be born if we had more information, and we're morally concerned about the fact we don't have that information so that we could abort if we made the decision to do so. In response to this study, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies has put out a report indicating that there is an ethical dimension to this, the use of any technology, frankly, but this technology graphically so, and yet they suggest there are two competing ethical issues here. The first is the ethical issue raised by the decision to abort a child because it doesn't meet our genetic expectations. But on the other side, and this is a more commonly encountered argument now, the responsibility, the moral responsibility, some will argue, for the parents who have this information to abort the child rather than to inflict it upon the larger society. So there you have a clash of worldviews, a clash of moral visions, and a clash of basic understandings of what's at stake, morally speaking, when it comes to the question of prenatal genetic information and the sanctity of human life. The author of this article is R.J. Creighton, and she ends by saying this, "While there are certain ethical issues that come alongside increased genetic testing," that's something of an understatement I would inject, she says, "I think a study like this is a good thing. Adding more certainty to the mix can only help parents make a truly informed choice in a difficult situation." We have to ask the obvious question here, informed by what? There's a very sad irony, indeed a tragic irony, in the fact that this research report comes out during what America observes as Down Syndrome Awareness Month. That awareness month has been put together especially by the parents and families of Down Syndrome citizens in the United States as a reminder of the dignity and sanctity of their lives and what they contribute to our culture. During this month, we are reminded also of the fact that in America today, there is such a stigma against children with Down Syndrome that the abortion of Down Syndrome children is now considered to be routine in many communities. I've mentioned on this broadcast before a conversation I had with an obstetrician in the Los Angeles area who reflected on this by telling me that he had not delivered a Down Syndrome baby in a number of years. That's not because they were not conceived. It is because they were not born. Just remember that principle made very clear by Martin Niemöller, the German pastor during World War II. He said, first they came for others, and then they came for yet others, and then they came for me. Well, first they come for the Down Syndrome babies. Pretty soon they'll be coming for others who simply do not meet genetic expectations. And we need to remember that every single one of us, every single human being, has genetic flaws. How many flaws would it take for our parents to decide? We just don't come up to muster. Finally, as the week comes to an end, once again we are reminded of the limitations of human justice. A federal judge in Michigan sentenced this week the former mayor of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick, to 28 years in prison. He was convicted on 24 counts that included charges of racketeering and extortion. As the New York Times explains, this meant that his name was added to a list of 18 city officials in Detroit who were convicted of corruption during his tenure as mayor. Detroit, as you may recall, has recently filed for bankruptcy, the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history. In this case, many of the problems of Detroit are directly traceable to Kwame Kilpatrick, who at 31 was elected as the youngest mayor in the city's history, a man who was believed to be of great promise, but that promise became sullied by the fact that he was convicted of perjury and sent to jail and now convicted of 24 other counts, including corruption and racketeering. As some legal and political observers have noted, this former mayor basically killed a city. As one man said, quote, it was a house of cards. Kilpatrick was the last card. He fell and knocked everything down. He didn't start Detroit's problems, including its pension crisis and its economic crisis. He's not responsible for the major changes in the economy that led to the downsizing of the auto industry. But he was responsible for his corruption and racketeering and for the fact that this was the final straw for the city of Detroit. How does a city rebuild itself on the other side of this kind of political disaster? How does a system of human justice come to terms with this? As the old Gilbert and Sullivan musical reminds us, the punishment is to fit the crime. The punishment to fit the crime. But how does a punishment fit this crime? This judge has sentenced the former mayor to 28 years in prison, but that will not return Detroit to its financial solvency. It will not solve the bankruptcy problem. Once that egg is broken, you cannot put it back together again. No human court of justice can restore the damage that has been done by human sin in this case. But if that's true in the case of Kwame Kilpatrick, it's actually the human story of sinfulness writ large. That's an interesting place for us to end the briefing this week, with the necessity of divine justice. Because at the end of the day, we can't achieve true justice. Only God can. Our courts must do what they must and do what they can. But at the end of the day, the people in Detroit must be saying, where do we get our city back? That's what it means to live east of Eden. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.